we need to change things fundamentally while people will still even give us an opportunity to do so. Like, it will even give us the trust and confidence to think that we can change things for the better. Because, like, the ultimate enemy here is just despair, is just utter hopelessness and despair.
Whatever Joe Biden does, if he gets elected, it has to be big. It has to be bold. You know, there's no doubt that the Affordable Care Act was a big leap forward. But it was, as the president said the other day, President Obama, it was never meant to be the final step. It was a step forward. There is an opportunity to do big structural things like the one you've suggested, universal basic income. I think the things that have seemed sort of utopic and radical in the past now seem like pragmatic answers to a large number of Americans.
I am thrilled to welcome to Yank Speaks, or vice versa. This is the Yank Speaks Axe Files crossover. It's like a superhero team up, Marvel DC.
Yeah, exactly. No, it's great to be with you, Andrew, always. And what an irresistible pairing, you know?
Yes, it's like half of a CNN studio has come to life.
Someone's exactly. And everybody misses those. So how have you been?
Yeah, I've been good in the scheme of things. Just working hard, trying to do as much positive stuff as possible, get money out to people. We're now at $6.5 million in direct economic aid to people in micro grants of between $250 to $1,000. I just launched this data dividend project this week. I don't know if you saw that. We're trying to get people paid for their data. So that's really exciting and positive. So we're staying busy, just trying to do good things, obviously trying to help Joe whenever they ask me for help. Or so we're hosting an event for him online with Tammy Duckworth next week.
That's great. That's great. Well, he must be feeling good right now. Sitting on top. If anyone had told you that going into July that Joe Biden would be leading the race by 12 to 14 points, you would have told them they were nuts. And it speaks to the caprice of American politics, because no one could have foreseen in the early part of this year all of the intervening events that have really exposed Trump in a very, very dramatic way. You know, there's all this talk about masks. He's really been unmasked by these crises, and it's turned this race on its head.
Yeah, the bunker strategy of Joe Biden, which obviously is not like a real strategy. I mean, it just sort of like happened. But I experienced it on the trail, where I remember when he won Massachusetts and he literally spent 0 days in Massachusetts and $0 and zero staff. And seeing that, it's like, wow, like Joe, like Joe can win without setting foot anywhere in the state. And I think we're seeing that again now, where Joe's built up name recognition and familiarity is so high with so many Americans that it's not like you need to see him necessarily every day on your TV screen or at a local rally in order to feel like you know him and that you're willing to support him.
Yeah, you know, I don't know. I think in some ways he's a very familiar figure, in other ways he's not. I think that the way people know him, though, is the most significant way right now, which is they know him to be a decent human being. They know him to be an empathetic human being. They know him to be a caring human being. And those are qualities that they are sorely lacking, or that they see as sorely lacking in Trump in the midst of these crises. And so it's really multiplied Biden's advantages. But that whole strategy of not going and not spending any money, man, if you had just done that, imagine you could have been the nominee if you just spent nothing and gone nowhere.
Yes, David, if I just had proper advice and guidance instead of these other jokers that I had. Here's the plan, Andrew. Bask in total anonymity, and then you will be catapulted to the front of the pack. It'll be the greatest political jujitsu anyone has ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the strategy requires total familiarity before you start basking in anonymity. But listen, your team and you did an amazing job because you literally started in total anonymity, and you made yourself a factor in the presidential race. And that's a hard thing to do. You know, 25 people or whatever the number was ran and a handful of people really elevated themselves in that race. You were one of those people. Nobody would have bet on your surviving as long as you did in that race. So all kidding aside, hats off to you and your team because you ran an unconventional campaign and you captured the imagination of a lot of people. So there's a lot to be said for that.
Well, thank you, David. You and I had a chance to spend time together on that trail. I was with you at the University of Chicago, which was a tremendous event. We also bonded over our families. How are you and your family faring during this time?
We did bond over that, and it was something I deeply appreciated. We both have special needs kids. My daughter is grown now. She just turned 39 years old. And the hardest thing about this siege, this COVID-19 siege, has been that she lives in a wonderful place near us in Chicago. And they are taking wonderful care to make sure that she and her friends are not being exposed to the virus. But the requirement is that she either comes home and stays with us for the duration of the virus, or she stays where she lives in the place where she lives, and we can't physically see her because they don't want anybody coming in or out who might infect.
That makes sense. So it was an either or situation.
And she's, look, they're doing a great job. There's lots going on there. She loves being with her friends. And so we couldn't remove her from that. She would have gone crazy after a week of being away from them. But it's hard. And she's getting frustrated. She has, she has a job she can't go to. And she'd like to come home and visit and so that's been very painful to be separated. But, in the main, look, what I found, Andrew, and you probably as well, if you were lucky going into this, you're probably handling it pretty well. I was lucky enough. I mean, I'm lucky enough to be lucky in that I have places to be out of the crosshairs of the virus. My wonderful wife and I have been married for 40 plus years, and we still can stand being under the same roof with each other and enjoy that. And I've spent time, my son came down to our place with his fiance. We spent a month with them at the beginning of this.
Wow. So you must have gotten to know her much, much better. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, these were all great benefits, but, I'm cognizant every day that it hasn't been as easy for a lot of people in this country. And what it's done is expose the fault lines in our economy that you talked to so eloquently throughout your campaign. People are, there are people who live in this country who are one catastrophe away from ruin. And the catastrophe came, and you see a lot of small business people losing their businesses. You see many people losing their jobs, and obviously a lot of people suffering with this virus. One of the things that is bugging me this week is this unbelievable scenario where the president of the United States, who's in charge of running the government that we count on to respond to the virus, is also leading the resistance to the advice that his own government is giving. And so at a time when Arizona, which is a place where I spend a lot of time, Arizona is now headed into the red zone in terms of this virus. He arrives and the other day spends time in an arena, or I guess it was a mega church with 3,000 young people crammed together, no mask. And it is exactly the scenario that the CDC has warned about. And so you see the president of the United States actually aiding and abetting this virus. And, you know, it's it is something I thought I'd never see. You know, so I feel for everybody who is suffering with the virus, who've lost loved ones, and who've lost their livelihoods as a result of this. It's a terribly difficult time.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I've always been a mattress guy because I figured if I'm going to do something for up to 8 hours, maybe I should do it right. And Helix Sleep lets you do it right by sending you one of 20 unique mattresses that's tailored for you. I took the Helix Sleep quiz, takes only a couple minutes, and I was matched with a Helix Dawn mattress because I wanted something that felt firm and I sleep on my back. That mattress is exactly what I needed, but strangely enough, my kids now seek out that mattress in the house and want to sleep on it even though I did not order it with them in mind. If you have a high quality mattress, it is a game changer, a huge difference maker. Don't take my word for it. Helix has been awarded the number one mattress picked by GQ and Wired magazine. It is even recommended by multiple leading chiropractors and doctors of sleep medicine as a go-to solution for improving your sleep. Helix is offering up to 30% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang. That's helixsleep.com/yang. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now. It's a catastrophic time. There was a commentator called it the Omnicrisis, which I've since adopted. But you have this pandemic that then is giving rise to depression era levels of unemployment. And then now we have police brutality, civil unrest layered on top of it. And no, like, how do you dig out of this when your president is literally just, as you say, going against public health experts, going against common sense? We have to start digging out of this. And I think all the time about the people who've lost their livelihoods. I just saw a story where 95% of New York real estate in Manhattan is still unused. And so you have these hot dog vendors and coffee vendors who like push their trucks out to the offices waiting for customers, and then no customers ever come. You know, I mean, how long can that go on for those families? To me, we should be dumping money into the economy and people's households as quickly as possible. Just say, look, the economy's on fire, people's lives are getting destroyed. Like, we just need to try and put the fire out. And to me, it's a mystery where if 72% of Americans are for cash relief, like, why isn't Congress debating that every day? I feel like that's bipartisan. The polls I saw said a majority of Republicans and independents are for cash relief, as well as Democrats. So that to me is like is something I also spend a lot of time on right now, is trying to help candidates push that bill through Congress. It's being considered in the House right now and Senate. It's got, I believe, it's up to a couple dozen co-sponsors. And in some cases, Humanity Forward is supporting opponents of members of Congress who are not signed on to the cash relief bill. Because to me, mm-hmm. right now, if you're not into cash relief, then you're just missing what's happening.
Well, and I think it speaks to the wisdom of your longer term proposal for universal basic income, to put that floor beneath people, and also to recognize that people have worth in our society who are not rewarded for that now, including parents who who are home and taking care of a special needs child for one example. But, you know, one of the things that has been interesting and exasperating is listening to the president, and all when he talks about the economy, all he talks about is the stock market. Well, half the Americans don't have stocks, don't have equities, and that's not where the crisis is. You know, and I understand that it's important for corporate America to have capital, and I'm not, you know, but the real crisis is in the ability of people day to day to survive in a time when our economy is still in many ways shut down. It's certainly not at full throttle. So your proposal takes on new resonance because, as I said before, it's not just this crisis, but there are families all over this country who are a tragedy away from another financial crisis, and that will be true even when the economy is restored.
Yeah, the economy being restored, I've been trying to figure out what the recovery looks like, and the estimates I've seen say that 42% of the jobs are gone for good, which makes sense to me. I would estimate half, and so if economists come in with 42, I'd say okay, 40 to 50% of these jobs are gone forever. That alone puts you at 16 to 18 million jobs gone. And we can look around us that many of these states that are reopening, they're not coming back 100% full bore. I mean, you can see in the restaurants and bars, and I haven't been to an airport, but I'm pretty sure that airport's fairly sparsely used right now.
Manifestly, yeah.
And you just mentioned, I mean, we're seeing surges in cases in Arizona and Texas and Florida that are going to end up having, you know, like obviously a huge dampener on anyone feeling secure and going out and doing things that would help drive the economy. To me, at this point, the main variable is the vaccine. And when you and I were talking about this election in November, Trump's down by an historic amount for an incumbent at this point. I mean, you know much more about past elections than I do.
Certainly,
I'm fairly sure it's unusual for the incumbent to be down 12 points, you know, for 4 months out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think this is a very pronounced deficit for an incumbent, and frankly, given how inelastic our electorate has been, it's a big margin for any race at this point. That said, 4 months ago, we didn't foresee any of this. We don't know what the next 4 months are going to hold. We know that Trump is a guy who is completely untethered by norms and will do anything to win, and he's got the levers of government. I expect on the vaccine, he will, under any circumstance, he will announce a vaccine. Whether that vaccine materializes or not after November 3rd, he will announce a vaccine. And he will overrule Republicans in the Senate, and he will extend unemployment insurance. And frankly, he should do that. But, you know, he has some tools available to him to try and change this thing up. And then we have the issue of voting and how that's going to go, and the opportunity for voter suppression. And so, you know, my advice to the Biden camp is to enjoy these numbers, but don't inhale. Because there's a lot to go here, and you've got to, you know, in baseball they say, see the ball into the glove, make sure that you catch it. They've got to see this right to the very end, Trump is not going to go out meekly. He will, you know. Now I think, Andrew, that his problem is that his reaction is to double down on what he knows. I mean, he hasn't shown the ability. I mean, what is killing him right now is his own behavior, the way he's handled this virus, and the initial denial, and now another round of denial, telling people that this thing is going away at the very time that, and standing in the very state where, no, it's actually peaking again. it makes him look obtuse and completely focused on his own storyline rather than reality. His handling on the issue, his handling of race, you know, now kneeling was his tactic back in 2016. No, he was the guy who made Colin Kaepernick, who put a big target on Colin Kaepernick. Now he says he's going to use U.S. Marshals to protect statues around the country. And he just announced, I guess, that he's going to have a big event at Mount Rushmore on the 3rd of July. So what you see is this is his new kneeling is going to be protecting statues. And, you know, it's code for other things, but he doesn't have the ability, you know, the American people, it seems to me, are showing great character in their reaction to all of this. And he is not, and they know it. And what's driving his numbers down is just how miserably he's handled the virus, how miserably he's handled this race issue. You know, when the economy was going well and everything seemed to be going well, people who were on the bubble would say, you know, I hate the way Trump behaves, but everything's going well. And, you know, he's strong and he knows how to get things done and so on. Well, now he doesn't look very strong. And the cost of incompetence and divisiveness and narcissism is becoming very clear to people. And it's going to be hard for him to come back from that. You know, not that he can't, but it is he's in a very deep hole and he's got the shovel in his hand.
I couldn't agree more. 72% of Americans in one survey I saw said this is the darkest time in American history in their lifetimes. I mean, that's not the kind of thing that makes you want to sign up for four more years of the incumbent. And
yeah,
you look at this and he's dug himself an historic hole. I agree that his go-to playbook is looking worse and worse. Like, you know, just trying to lean into some cultural flashpoint and say, look, I'm here defending the statues. I'm here. I'm going to go to Mount Rushmore, the Kung Flu, or like, you know, whatever distraction he's going to try and use. I feel like it's not working and he's getting increasingly desperate because he can sense that none of it is working, but he doesn't really have another playbook to go to. And to me, Democrats are so traumatized by 2016 where anytime you say to them, hey, Joe's winning, they're like, oh no, but we thought Hillary was winning and look what happened. So don't believe the polls. No, Trump is going to pull a repeat. So I look at the 4.5 months ahead and I agree with you that that's like the major variables, that 4 months ago, we couldn't have predicted this. So what happens in the next 4 months? Is there a vaccine that changes people's mindset or a sense about the future? The debates would be another possibility. I suppose, though I'm skeptical that would actually be a key
Let me interrupt you on the debates, because I think it's a really interesting thing. You know, the Trump strategy right now is Biden is an addled, you know, weak, doddering old man, and he's not really in control. In Tulsa, he said, you know, he's going to surrender everything to the radical left, to the mob, and so on. But the other half of that equation is he's arguing that Biden doesn't have the strength to bring the economy back. And now, but the whole premise is Biden doesn't have the mental acuity to be president, which is kind of remarkable coming from a president who advised the country to ingest Lysol as a strategy for dealing with COVID-19. I mean, he's not exactly a poster child for mental acuity. But beyond that, he's really lowering the bar for Biden in these debates. I mean, he is painting such a dark picture of Biden's capacities that when Biden shows up, and you were on a debate stage with
seven times, yeah,
he's going to clear that bar. I feel pretty confident. And you know, back in you're too young to have focused on this, but 1980. Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter. The country, you know, it was double digit inflation and unemployment and you know, the country decided that
malaise,
stagflation,
forever.
Yeah. And he was going, and the country decided they were going to fire Jimmy Carter, but they weren't sure about Ronald Reagan. They felt he was too too extreme, too right wing, too dogmatic. And they had one debate, and Ronald Reagan showed up, and he was genial, and he was warm, and he was reassuring, and the bottom dropped out on Carter after that debate. You know, it's possible that Biden can actually seal this simply by clearing the very low bar that Trump has set for him. And that's the, you know, that's the downside of the Trump strategy. He's painting Biden in a way that I think Biden can easily swat aside, and so he may have been, he may be setting his own trap here, Trump.
That's a great point. It's true that if you present Joe as completely infirm, then he shows up and is completely normal, stable, competent, fired up. Not, doesn't even need to be fired up, is what you're suggesting, as long as he clears a low bar. Now, so I agree with your estimation that it's unlikely that the debates are going to somehow be some launching pad for Trump, particularly if he's saying that, you know, like Joe's this caricature of himself. And so I look up and I try and imagine what the paths to victory for Trump are. And to me, a lot of it comes down to voter suppression. Are people able to vote in November and have their votes counted? We're seeing already now with all the mail-in votes at the state level. Well, first we saw massive lines and difficulties in Georgia, but then we're also seeing a multi-day counting period for mail-in votes in many states. And so the questions in my mind are around November 3rd, it happens, and then are we going to know, like, whether that vote ends up being something that people have trust and confidence in? Like, that to me is a major variable that it's tough to predict or forecast. I think that would be one way you can imagine this somehow going very, very, very badly for the country as a whole if you wind up with this contested election that drags on for days and days.
Well, listen, Andrew, there are only two outcomes in Donald Trump's estimation. Either he wins or the election was stolen. He doesn't allow for any third option. And you know that he's already setting up the storyline, mail-in votes lead to fraud. I think that's a little bit of a trap for himself, too, because he's making mail-in voting socially unacceptable for his own voters. That could end up hurting him. But you can see what he's doing. And yes, I think if you look at the elections we just had, these primaries in Kentucky and New York, we're not going to know the outcome for a week or more because of mail-in voting. That is very likely going to happen in states around the country in 2020 in the fall. And there could not be a worse time for that. If you had a person who had some regard for our institutions and his constitutional place in Donald Trump, it would be one thing. But he cannot accept defeat, and so he will instead try to tear down the process and create a sense of jaundice about the result. And he'll have help in that. I mean, this is part of the Russian project and other malign forces in the world who want to create doubts in the minds of Americans about their own democracy. So it is you're absolutely right to point that out. And it is a great concern. And we all ought to be eyes open about this and as much as possible resist the temptation to be, or not the temptation, but resist the impulse to be manipulated by our worst fears here. I mean, the fact is, there is no history of massive voter fraud in our country, nor is there a history of massive voter fraud or any major voter fraud attributed to mail-in voting. And we should not allow that storyline to compound.
Yeah, so that to me is the biggest unknown, most legitimate concern, because I look at it and I don't think the economy is going to come roaring back between now and November. I think the vaccine's a major variable that you're right that he may move heaven and earth to have something that he can at least talk about, but it's not like anyone's going to be actually vaccinated at any scale right prior to election day. So to me, the landscape is very pro Joe, and I mean, he's up now. Like, I don't see that changing barring something calamitous on the Joe side, really. You know, like it's because Trump is digging himself a deeper and darker hole. I think a lot of it is just that Democrats are very, very scarred, where they just cannot bring themselves to breathe easy, which I understand, because you have to run through the tape and see the ball into the glove, as you're saying. Like, we have to work. I mean, it's one reason why I'm co-hosting events for Joe and doing everything I can to help him win. But to me, objectively, Joe is winning, Trump is losing, and there's no reason to think that something's going to turn that around in the near future, unless the process ends up being such a mess that we can't have confidence in the results. So that's something I'm also trying to help with on the side. There are some people I know who are working on clearly the mail-in voter provisions in states around the country. I mean, to the extent that those aren't in place in some states, you have to ask yourself, like, what the heck are you doing, especially given the current backdrop.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. A few decades ago, private citizens used to be largely that. Private. What's changed? The internet. Think about everything you've browsed, searched for, watched, or tweeted. Now imagine all that data being crawled through, collected, and aggregated by third parties into a permanent public record. Your record. Having your private life exposed for others to see was once something only celebrities worried about. But in an era where everyone is online, everyone is a public figure. To keep my data private when I go online, I turn to ExpressVPN. Do you know there are hundreds of data brokers out there whose sole business is to buy and sell our data? The worst part is you don't know what they're doing. You don't get to have your say. That's why I use ExpressVPN. Just hit one button and then your internet connection gets rerouted through an encrypted server. No one can see your IP address. You're completely in your own private internet. Every time I turn ExpressVPN on, I'm given a random IP address shared by other ExpressVPN customers. That makes it harder for third parties to track me and harvest my data. No matter what device you're on, you just hit one button and you get your own protected connection. So if, like me, you believe that your data is your business, secure yourself with the number one rated VPN on the market. Visit expressvpn.com/yang and get 3 extra months for free. That's expressvpn.com/yang. Go to expressvpn.com/yang to learn more.
You know, one thing I wanted to talk to you about, I mean, you have like this storied political history helping many people win. The one that we all, I believe, know you for most prominently is obviously Barack Obama. You helped get him into the White House, I guess twice, if you want to look at it that way. You helped him get him into the White House and stay in the White House. And you'd been working with him for years and years. And I read this op-ed that you wrote that I believe was in the Washington Post, where you've been an ally to not just Barack, but black politicians for decades.
Yeah.
And you've considered yourself...
My whole career, really.
Yeah, your entire career. So you consider yourself someone who's helped make history on that side, and yet now you're thinking that the work that you've done wasn't enough, that there were disparities that were bigger and deeper even than what you were seeing. And I feel like many Americans have also been awakened to some of these harsh racial inequities by the killing of George Floyd and Black Lives Matter.
Yeah, listen, I think this is a historic moment. You know, I've lived through a lot of these moments in the television age. And, you know, I remember what the civil rights movement did in terms of raising consciousness, the brutal assault on marchers at Selma led to the Voting Rights Act. But this is different. This because for the first time in my lifetime, and I think for the first time in the life of our country, there is a broad public discussion about institutional racism, systemic racism that really flows back to the beginnings of our country. And what I wrote was that I am ashamed that I haven't spent more time thinking about that systemic racism. And, you know, I have, I've worked for a lot of candidates of color from the beginning of my career as a political strategist, and I help, you know, break down these barriers. But I haven't had a lot of conversations with my Black friends about what their day-to-day lives are like. What are the things that they face? What were their encounters with police like? What were their, you know, what were the barriers that they faced at work? What are the slights that they've endured? You know, there, you know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar said, you know, when you expose it to the light, when you expose America to the light, you know, you see racism everywhere. That is true. And we have just accepted this as a kind of, well, that's, you know, those things are sort of a part of life. And I think that a lot of people are now taking another look and saying it's not just how police treat citizens, police treat people of color. It is pervasive in the workplace. It is pervasive in social settings. We just never have afforded to our Black brothers and sisters their full rights. We have not. It has not happened in 400 years, and I think people are. That's why I think Trump is meeting such resistance here. There is even people who are not really that motivated by this issue understand that the last thing we need is more divisiveness. The last thing we need is more appeals to separation, to discrimination and bias and so on. I mean, Trump has weaponized race as an issue at a time when people want everyone to put those weapons down and focus on the real issue.
Yes. Yeah. How can we start to heal and address some of these century-old inequities? Certainly for me, part of it is universal basic income and starting to balance out the economy in ways that work for people of every background, but particularly for people of color and women and folks who are completely marginalized by our current economy, which is going to be more and more of us. And I obviously made the case that it's going to be a lot of us due to technological change, but it was already happening to Black and brown people and women and underrepresented minorities and a lot of the people that we're talking about. You just need to try and make things work better for more people. And the most direct, straightforward way we could do it would just be to start putting money into people's hands directly so that your kids have a better chance to learn, you have a better chance to think. I just met yesterday with four women, they were all women, in the Bronx who received $1,000 from Humanity Forward. We gave $1,000 to 1,000 people in the Bronx that were identified as struggling economically. And one of them said that she had, I don't know if she was exaggerating, but she said she had $5 in the bank and then she got 1,000. So then it was like 1,005. And she said that it helped her think more clearly. And that really was like a punch in the gut for me, because I think that there are so many people in our country that have I can relate to that. Now, certainly this doesn't solve all of the racial inequities that we're talking about, but at least it gets us like, you know, like a little bit down that path. My greatest fear, David, is that things just aren't working for more and more Americans. And you and I, for better or for worse, are like part of these institutions and frameworks and like, you know, establishments. And like I can see for many, many Americans, like they're just losing confidence that any of our stuff is working. And that there's like a presumption to the work that you and I do, which is like, look, if we can get some people into power and pass some policies and like actually try and right this ship, we can improve things. But I feel like fewer and fewer people are listening, and that there's like less and less trust and faith that, one, we know what we're talking about or can like understand what other people are going through. And two, that there's actually going to be something meaningful that changes for them.
Yeah.
Like there's like, and I've called it like the era of institutional decline or era of institutional distrust. And at this point, it's rational to distrust, which is freaking terrible. Yeah. But like, I think that's where it's gotten to for many, many people. And for these issues of racism, it's so deeply embedded where like, if you're a black person looking up and saying like Cornel West, this also hit me like a gut punch when Cornel West said like, look, we've tried black faces in high places and nothing has changed for us. So like, what do you expect us to do at this point? And you hear that and you're like, holy crap, like we need to change things fundamentally while people will still even give us an opportunity to do so. Like it will even give us the trust and confidence to think that we can change things for the better. Because like the ultimate enemy here is just despair, is just utter hopelessness and despair. And I can see despair growing and rising throughout the country. I mean, right now we have like, you know, this omni crisis, like mental health crisis that pre-existed before the pandemic. And now like the mental health crisis on steroids. And so thinking that we're going to somehow reason people to a point where it's like, no, if we come together, we can do X and Y and Z. Like people are just losing hope.
Yeah. Listen, I think that we are at a critical juncture, and there's no doubt you're right about a crisis of confidence about all our institutions. And, you know, it comes at a time when change is coming more rapidly than ever. And because of social media, there is an immediacy to all of this that I think creates that adds to the anxiety. And so we have government. This is a mismatch that's always bothered me, or that's been bothering me lately. You've got government that is designed in a democracy to move slowly when public opinion is divided. And we've seen the impact of that over the last many years. And then you have change coming more rapidly than ever because of largely because of technology. You know, that is a very, very difficult mismatch. And, it, you know, what I think more than anything is that whatever Joe Biden does if he gets elected, it has to be big. It has to be bold. There has to be a willingness to really rethink fundamental institutional relationships. And he's got to do things that, if he gets elected, he will have to do things that really substantively make a difference. You know, there's no doubt that the Affordable Care Act was a big leap forward. But it was, as the president said the other day, President Obama, it was never meant to be the final step. It was a step forward and it needs to be accelerated. I think there's an opportunity to do that now. I think there's a public receptivity to do it, especially after the crisis has laid bare so many of the problems with our health system. I think that, you know, there is an opportunity to do big structural things like the one you've suggested, universal basic income. But, you know, I look at these, for example, these inner city communities. I live on the south side of Chicago, and I've seen communities hollowed out, all the economic activity gone, schools not what they need to be, and, you know, all the sort of pillars of those communities are gone. And these kids are growing up in an environment with a lot of violence. And, you know, it is, to me, I don't know how kids come out of that environment without PTSD because it's just so stressful.
Many of them do have PTSD. I mean, there was like the right. ACEs, the trauma studies. Like, you can't learn if you're getting traumatized, you know, at home or in your neighborhood. And unfortunately, that's the reality for many, many of our kids.
So we need to make big investments to change that. And, you know, I mean, I know reparations is a very loaded term, but we do have a debt that we have to pay. And it should be, and there should be transformation of neighborhoods. And, you know, look, there's economic depression, not just in the African-American community, that has to be addressed. And we should say that as well. The impacts of change that you've talked about so eloquently have hit a broad swath of communities. It's just that the African-American community started off behind in so many ways because of the institutional barriers that we've created. So there's a lot of work to be done. But here's the good news. I think the things that have seemed sort of utopic and radical in the past now seem like pragmatic answers to a large number of Americans. I think there's more of a receptivity to fundamental changes that aren't just nibbling at the margins. And I hope that if Joe Biden becomes president, that he and his team take advantage of that and really advance a visionary set of policies that will make change and that will appear to people in their lives as important in making change. These democratic institutions, you know, these democratic institutions rely on the confidence of people in them to actually promote meaningful policy and change. And now more than ever, that's important. And by the way, you know, you're a very successful business person. This is true of capitalism as well. I think there's a crisis of capitalism and a crisis of democracy, and they're intertwined. And capitalists need to become part of the solution here. This, you know, the idea of more and more inequality, of more wealth aggregation at the top while large numbers of Americans are struggling below, that's an unsustainable model. And we need our leaders to make that clear. And we need business leaders to step forward and say, we understand and we're going to bring about fundamental changes.
Yeah, the argument I've made is that we're just measuring our economy all wrong, that we should be measuring it by human well-being, health, mental health, freedom from substance abuse, childhood success rates, environmental sustainability, and things that would actually speak to how we're doing as a society. Because to your earlier point, the stock market and how families are doing have essentially no relationship anymore. I mean, when these companies announce layoffs, their stock price goes up, and you can see clearly that many of these companies can do more with fewer workers. People increasingly are seen as like a drag on your business.
Yeah, and that's a big danger. Now, you know, one of the things I remember so clearly from my tenure in the White House during the last economic crisis was, you know, companies innovated and they figured out how to do more with fewer people because labor is a large part of their overhead. And so
costs.
And you're going to see that this time as well. And, that is a big concern as we come out of this. So there is this is a very momentous time. You know, it started off as a year about Trump or not Trump, but these serial crises have really exposed not just him, but the work that we have to do as a country, and people are really focused on it. And I think that's positive, but only if our leaders respond.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We need a new deal, a new American social contract, a new Marshall Plan for the United States of America. I don't know which of those three you like the best in terms of framing it.
Probably, but, you know, all of them are set in a different time. I'm not sure that most Americans know what the Marshall Plan was anymore, but the principle is absolutely right.
How about we could try America 2.0? Does that work for you, or is that too wonky and futuristic?
Well, that's certainly contemporary. That may be a little too bloodless, but it gets to the point, which is we've got to retool here. We need a new model within the framework of our democracy and our economic system. We need a brand new model that enhances opportunity for the broadest number of people.
David, I'm legitimately going to pick your world-class political professional brain for a minute, because I've been trying to figure out how to pitch this most effectively. So my instinct, and it's very consistent with me and who I am, is to say America 2.0, but I was afraid that might seem alienating to some people. And so I was reaching backwards and using things like New American Contract, New Deal, Marshall Plan, which you're probably right, people don't even know what the Marshall Plan is anymore.
Right.
So in your professional opinion, what should we call this effort to reinvent America so that it's actually working for most of us, all of us ideally, but more of us?
Well, first, let me offer this disclaimer, because in the past, when I threw these ideas out, it generally followed a period of reflection and testing. So I kind of knew how people reacted to these things. But, you know, the idea, relaunch America, is something that I would think about. This idea of an inflection point that has a hopeful feel to it. To me, 2.0 is a bit too sterile and clinical. Relaunch America, I kind of like that.
Relaunch America.
Yeah.
Well, David, if you see that on billboards all over the country, you'll know where it came from, that we came up with it during this conversation.
Well, take it from an old political hack, my friend. Test it before you use it. Because the great thing about, everybody thinks of research polling and focus groups as manipulative tools of a cynical political industry. But what I've learned over 40 years as a reporter and as a strategist is that the wonderful thing about people is they are counterintuitive. They bring to it things that you may not think about. So I'm always eager to hear what people have to say about it.
Oh, no, don't worry, David. Feel like we tested the heck out of everything at the Yang campaign. Yeah. We were like data, data, data. So, that's how we came up with Freedom Dividend. We just like tested every name we could think of. Social Security for
that
all.
That was a good one.
Universal Basic Income.
Yeah. Well, test Relaunch America, because I think...
We'll test Relaunch America.
I think post-Trump and given all these crises, I think there may be a receptivity to that. So we'll see. That's my entry.
I couldn't agree more. People want to know that we recognize the severity of the crises, the hole that we're in, the hole that many families are in. Like, we have to call an end to business as usual, because people are dying, people are suffering, ways of life are disintegrating. I think all the time again about all these small business owners who are getting decimated, and the families in the Bronx I talked to yesterday who were just looking up saying, like, where the heck am I going to get next month's rent? Like, it's everybody. And we have to go much, much bigger. When I've talked to Joe, he's seemed to me to recognize the need. it's funny because like no one thought of Joe Biden as like the transformational figure. He's like, I'm going to change everything. I mean, that's actually one of the reasons why some people were supportive of some of his opponents, like me, perhaps. I mean, having run against Joe seeing that, the love that many people have for him out on the trail, I believe that he is determined to step up. Like I don't think he's going to go and say like, hey, let's just like nibble at the edges. Like I think he understands that we do need like a relaunch America. We'll have to present to him the data on how best to name this thing. So job number one is have him be our president. And then job number two is actually, and I actually am going to say this, and these could be famous last words. I'm much more concerned about what happens after Joe becomes president than I am winning the election. Like I believe that Joe is going to win and become our president, but then the real work begins because we're still going to have like tens of millions of Americans who are completely at a loss as to what the way forward looks like.
Yeah, I just I think that's such an important point, you know, because there is there's a passionate desire to get past this Donald Trump era, and I understand it. But if that's all that happens, that's not enough. And my sense is that that's not what Biden wants. I know Biden well enough to believe that if he wins, he's going to want to make his years as president count. He's going to want to be remembered for something more than just being the guy who beat Donald Trump. And let me tell you the opportunity that he has. You know, one of the reasons why he's doing as well as he's doing in the polling, and I wrote a piece about this the other day on CNN.com, is that he is culturally inconvenient for Donald Trump. He is just not scary to the people who Donald Trump hopes to scare about the Democratic nominee. And Trump kind of acknowledged it last week in Tulsa last weekend when he said when he talked about Biden being the, you know, addled sort of captive of the radical left. But he said now he's not radical left. He's never been radical left. And I think that was an admission that they just can't make him scary. So they're going to try and make his friends scary. But the opportunity that, and you can see it in the numbers, Andrew, he's doing far better among white voters. He's doing better, certainly better among college educated white voters who Trump carried last time. And he's pared the margin down among non-college educated white voters. He's even pared the margin down among white evangelical voters. But Biden, I don't think people are going to look at Biden and say he is a radical, scary figure. And that gives him the opportunity to do some very bold, progressive things because people have confidence that he is not, that he's not going to throw the system away.
He's not an extremist. He's not an ideologue. He's a practical guy. Yeah, that's actually very, very important, where if Joe says, hey, we're going to do things big in this way, then it becomes the mainstream thing to do. Whereas if someone else had suggested it, you might look at it and say like, oh, that's very dramatic.
I think that's the opportunity that he has, and it's a great opportunity for the country. So, you know, I'm, and I also, the other thing I believe about Biden is if he becomes president, there is a wealth of talent just way, and I'm, you're one of them, Andrew, but there's a wealth of talent out there just waiting to be unleashed. And after 4 years of mediocrity and worse, and 4 years of subjugation of public institutions to the political whims of the president, and the dumbing down of government, there's just all this energy waiting to explode, to rehabilitate the government and innovate the government in a way that can be really historic. And Biden has that opportunity. And, you know, as you know, because you travel around, there's so many people who want to help. So, you know, he has to win the election. As you say, that's job number one. should not be taken for granted. And, you know, look, he's I think it is Biden's fundamental qualities that, as I said earlier, really have put him in a strong position here. Decency, empathy, you know, experience, solidity. But, you know, he's been swept along by forces no one could have predicted that have really exposed Trump in a big way. All that said, with all of this unpredictability, you know, I'm just, and knowing that Trump will do anything, you know, it is dangerous to be, it is dangerous to look past the election, and no one should do that.
Certainly, we have to fight to make sure that Joe does win, and then get to work. You actually have presented a very uplifting portrait of what is possible. I agree with it 100%, where I believe that we have to do big things and that Joe is going to be very, very open to doing things in a bigger way, and that he in some ways might be the ideal person to bring the rest of America along, that we have to think bigger. So this is the future we have to fight for. I don't know if it was your intention, David, but I think this might have been the most uplifting framing of a Biden presidency that I have seen. Maybe they could quote from this podcast, man. They can like somehow make an ad out of it, because that I think there's.
Well, listen, man.
Really
I don't recall Barack Obama ever being up by 14 points. So I don't know that they're looking for that much advice right now. They seem to be doing pretty well, and I give them all the credit for that. But you know, the one cautionary note about governance that I have to add is, there's still a Congress, and Joe Biden will respect the Congress as a co-equal branch of government, because he is a creature of that Congress where he spent 36 years, but. The Congress there was an intentional effort to block positive change during the years of Obama. And, Biden is going to face some of those same forces. There'll be Republicans who will say, if he fails, we win, zero-sum game. He will have Democrats. This is a diverse country, and Democrat Party, unlike the Republican Party, is a very diverse party, and there may not be a complete agreement on everything. So he's going to have to overcome those hurdles, and it will matter, who controls the Congress, because there was a vast difference in the first 2 years of the Obama presidency when Democrats controlled both houses of Congress, and the last six when they did not. That those are questions.
You remember it well. I mean, you were there.
Yeah.
You lived that difference very, very sharply. I know. Yeah. So you're right. We have to get some down ballot races across the finish line as well. We have to give the new administration a chance to succeed. And it's one reason I got to say, David, and I've done this, much less than you have, but supporting down ballot candidates is so fun and inspirational, because you talk to these folks who are running for state rep or Congress or sometimes senator, but generally something else. And they're such great people a lot of the time. You know, they're like running for office in their community in Austin, Texas, or Massachusetts, or wherever it is. I've really enjoyed the heck out of it.
I couldn't agree with you more. I am so inspired by people I meet around the country who step forward. You know, I have a young a student who's running for from the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago, named Zach Stepp, who's running for the legislature in Ohio. I think he must be 24 years old or something, but as smart and capable and well-motivated a young man as you'd ever want to meet. Just inspiring as all get out. And there are people all over this country like that. Working with young people gives me hope, because they are undaunted by the challenges and unbounded by conventional thinking, and they are all about trying to make the future better. And And I think they have the power to do it. So, yeah, I'm, you know, I wrote a book called Believer, Andrew. So I'm kind of, my brand is established. I tend to the optimistic side, but even in these dark days, I do see a better future, and I'm pulling hard for it.
I love it. Let's put some more young people in charge. I agree. I think if your Institute of Politics alums and students were in charge, we'd already be in much better shape, because having met them, they were so idealistic and energized. You do the next generation a great service, David, because like they, you know, they get from you a sense of both like practicality, but possibility. You know, like you've actually been there. You've been to the mountaintop. Wow. And I'm 100% sure that some of your students are going to wind up doing something incredible that makes us all proud and makes a huge difference.
Well, and right back at you. I mean, your candidacy inspired a lot of these young people to believe that there was another path. And, you know, so you've played a great role. And I know you'll continue to play a great role in blazing that trail. Anyway, listen, brother, it's great to be with you. I look forward to a time when we're not staring at each other through little boxes on a Zoom screen, but we can sit across a table again.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that too. All the best to you and the family. And yeah, we're going to do our best, man. We're going to get the next generation fired up and put them in position to lead us in the right direction.
Amen. Great to be with you.